Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel News. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You are going to hear from Steve. He's going to talk to you about Bill Everett and his return to the Submariner. And Kevin and company are back with another Thunderbolt segment covering issues 66 through 72, the Counter-Earth storyline. Let's see. For me, I don't have much. Sadly, I was just starting to read The Mighty Thor number 3 because I am a big, big fan of that series. I did read the first issue of The New Power Man and Iron Fist by David Walker and Sanford Green. That was fun. It was, it was fun. It was fun. There was a, there's a nice little Mary Jo Duffy cameo in the background there, but, overall, I enjoyed the issue. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. Reminds me a little bit of, it doesn't remind me really of the Priest written, I'm sorry, the Owsley written run that finished off the original series. Some of the more, maybe offbeat. I don't know if I'm using the right term there, but it is definitely a modern day story because we see Luke at home with the family. He is convincing Jessica and himself that he and Danny are not partners. They're not they are not heroes for hire anymore. So we'll see how that plays out because Danny is kind of convinced. It is the return of Heroes for Hire, and there's a callback to, they don't forget the history, which I really, really do appreciate, and the art is fitting. I really dig Sanford's style. Reminds me of Larry Stroman. It looks like it's going to be a good time. It may not always be fun, but I think what we're going to be getting is still worth our while. I did read the first issue of the Avenger Standoff Welcome to Pleasant Hill. That felt it. I am curious. I will absolutely say that. It's written by Nick Spencer, and you have art by pencils by Mark Bagley. It's definitely a setup issue. I guess Bucky had to come back to Earth in time for the movie. I was not really reading the his book, his Man on the Wall storyline. I will eventually. I'll go back to that, but it wasn't after Original Sin. I kind of really wasn't. Basically, The Mighty Thor is really the only best thing to come out of Original Sin. But the Pleasant Hill feels like it reminds me a little bit of some of the older crossover / tie-ins. Whenever the solo Avengers titles crossed over with each other, and then. Leading up to Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, Avengers, and so on. And that's what, that's the sense I got with this. And it's, should be, not, it doesn't seem like it's going to be as heavy as, say, something like Siege, or Fear Itself, or Civil War. But I am curious, especially since it ties into what was going on early on in the Sam Wilson, Captain America book. Some of the, we revisit some of what Maria Hill has said recently. So there was that. And I did happen to see Deadpool. Oh, I saw it twice, but I happened to see Deadpool. And I enjoyed it both times. And I would not mind seeing it again. I am not a huge Deadpool fan, I did finish the storyline, the first five issues of the current Deadpool series. I did not read the next two, the Deadpool 2099, not yet. But I was really, really looking forward to the movie based on everything that based on the commercials, the trailers. I'm a big Ryan Reynolds fan. I think he would absolutely make a great Deadpool, and I wasn't disappointed. I thought he was absolutely fantastic. No spoilers, but it was a great time, and it is not an all-ages movie. It is not for kids. There are definitely scenes. Yes, it's exaggerated, over the top, cartoony style violence, but there are also other situations and language. You know, you can walk down the street and hear things. So that's not, maybe not with the repetition, that it happens in this movie. So the language you have to watch out for, but you definitely have to, watch out for some of the other, situations that happen in the movie. But still, if you are a fan of the character, if you're of age and you're a fan of the character, it is very, very funny. The Easter eggs alone, I mean, you are going to see it more than once. It really was well done. It was told by people who are a fan of the character, who understand what kind of world that this character lives in. It was made for those same people who are aware of, the kind of situations that Deadpool puts himself in, that he is aware of, and it really, really was a good time. I'm done rambling. I have some other things to read. I'm going to get back to that. I'm going to let you guys do their thing, and we'll talk to everybody soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, classic comics connoisseurs. Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker. Before we get to the grand return of our Thunderbolts coverage, I want to tell you a little bit about one of my favorite comics creators. Bill Everett was a Golden Age comics artist, best known for creating the Submariner and writing and drawing Namor's adventures for Martin Goodman at Timely. First during the pre-Atlas, pre-Marvel days, when Timely's big three were Simon and Kirby's Captain America, Carl Burgos' Torch, and Everett Submariner. I should also say, Everett has an interesting lineage. He was a descendant of both William Blake and, more recently in his lineage, the founder of Dedham, Massachusetts. Everett later created the female spinoff to Namor, Namora, and wrote and drew her adventures, and returned to Namor for Atlas during the 50s, too, for a stint. He also provided a lot of memorable work for Timely Atlas on the war books and westerns, and I think most notably the Mystic anthology and the book Venus, turning that comic into a bona fide horror title, even though it had the beautiful blonde lead. Everett also worked in advertising, at one time being forced to do so, being a victim of the fallout of the Timely Atlas implosion when that occurred. If you remember what that was about, that Stan had, to keep his artists working, had continually built up a reservoir of stock inventory stories to help keep his artists working consistently, despite sales or the need for stories. And when Goodman discovered, as the story goes, the closet full of all these inventory stories, he had Stan basically fire everybody and broke the company down into almost a skeleton staff and just started pumping out, publishing all of the stuff in that stock room. Stan, at that time, he put both his neck and the company's neck out on the line, for the creators to keep his guys working. And Everett often was the beneficiary of that type of relationship with Stan. In fact, both Stan and Martin Goodman had a soft spot for Bill Everett. Everett, unfortunately, admittedly had a terrible drinking problem that really impacted his reliability. He had spent his teen years out west hanging out with rough and tumble cowboys and drinking heavy with them. They called him Wild Bill Everett, even. And so Everett moved kind of in and out of comics, sometimes wearing out his welcome with difficulty meeting deadlines and coming up with crazy excuses and reasons why he couldn't meet them. And that was a big issue when Stan brought Bill back during the early days of the Marvel Age of comics, too. Everett had a daughter who had significant impaired vision, and he marveled at the sensitivity of her other senses. And so with Stan, Bill co-created Daredevil. But unfortunately, beyond the first issue, Everett's reliability problems forced him off the book quickly. But despite that, he designed the character and the abilities and has left his mark on the character. Actually, the L.A. Rabbit and Dave Kay and I covered the Daredevil Marvel Masterworks Volume 1 that covers the origin of Daredevil and those first Everett contributions to it on Marvel Noise number 168, episode 168, in March of 2012. You can get those on marvelnoise.com. And also you can read much more about Bill's career and see loads of glorious artwork in Blake Bell's excellent Bill Everett Fire and Water coffee table art book published by Fantagraphics in 2010. And I covered that book somewhat in Marvel Noise episode 135 in October of 2010, shortly after Blake Bell's book came out. But what I wanted to briefly focus on here is the latter part of Bill's career, and unfortunately his life. When he beat his alcoholism through Alcoholics Anonymous, he returned to Marvel in the late 60s and early 70s with a real resurgence in his artwork. Everett floated around doing some work on the Hulk and Doctor Strange, and he also provided these ridiculously fine inks over Kirby on Thor, making Everett one of my favorite inkers over Kirby. He also is one of the few to ever successfully ink Gene Colan's pencils, I think, you know, along with Tom Palmer and Wally Wood. And who can forget all the hidden messages inked throughout those Thor issues, citing Princess Judy in 1969 and 1970, around like Thor 170, 171. Judy apparently was part of his alcoholism rehab. He had him like in the margins and in the ornateness of the Asgardian armor and architecture and stuff. It was wild. And speaking of Gene Colan, here's a little Marvel lore for you from the gentleman Gene himself. Everett was supposed to be the artist on Tomb of Dracula until Colan lobbied heavy for that position. Much to our benefit, I should say. In 1972, Bill Everett, the creator Martin Goodman said was always making a comeback, returned to both write and draw his most famous creation, Namor the Submariner, with issue number 50. Oh, also, here's a fun fact. Everett named his creation Namor because it sounded regal. It's Roman in reverse. Everett returned to Namor. I think it's topical right now because these issues have just been recently reprinted in the Submariner Marvel Masterworks Volume 7 hardcover that reprints issues 50 and 60 from 1972 and 1973. And this was a Marvel Masterworks I was really waiting for. I heard Whirlwindex Kevin saying that this Masterworks had got some criticism for them publishing it. I can't imagine why. The artwork inside is fantastic. His, you know, later of Star Reach fame, helped with scripting. And, you know, when Bill's health was failing him, he had been also a heavy smoker as well as an alcoholic, so that didn't help. And he wasn't doing well. His body wasn't holding up. And editor Roy Thomas split up issues with some reprints of former works of Everett on Submariner to kind of keep it the conceptual continuity going, and some backup stories and some fill-in issues and stuff. Everett was basically putting out one written, drawn, and inked book every other month. So as per Roy in his enjoyable and informative foreword in the Marvel Masterworks, Marvel adapted and really gave Everett every chance to guide the adventures of his creation, his signature creation, one last time. Unfortunately, at age 55, Bill suffered a massive heart attack and needed bypass surgery and died on the operating table in 1973. But this Submariner run, I love it. Yes, it's got some kooky, cartoony, Golden Age comics type things, like some silly crab monsters. Beat back those crabs, men! And, you know, a ridiculous Gorgo-like, intelligent, verbal, abominable Snow King monster. But, like Roy says, what he hoped the readers in the early 70s would do when he was the editor of the book, and I think it's even easier to do now, to just look past those elements and take in the other great stuff that this run has to offer. The artwork is superb, sublime, exquisite at times even. Everett's fine work never really reproduced fully in print. From the early days right up until these issues in the 1970s, so much was lost. The examples of original art that are in Blake Bell's Fire and Water book and in the back matter pages of this Marvel Masterworks hardcover reveal luscious depictions of the underwater environment, viscous as bodies are moving through it, the sea vessels, sea creatures, battles over the water, in the rain, all rendered so lushly. The owners of Everett's original art, among them Richard Howell and Carol Kalish, really have some masterpieces on their hands. Beautiful stuff. So also in these Submariner tales, Namora was revealed as deceased, but her teenage daughter, Namor's cousin, Namorita, was introduced. And what an introduction it was. Namor finds a girl caught up in some fishing lines. He thinks she's drowning, and he tries to give her mouth to mouth, and she wakes up and slaps him and calls him a perv and runs off and dives into the water. This is the early 70s. Everett was known for his beautiful drawings of women, at least known to me. I mean, he's right up there with Matt Baker and those classic, beautiful, Golden Age drawn women. Think of those old Namora faces even, and certainly Venus. But Namorina, she looked like a teenager. She had a teenager's build. Even though she was wearing a swimsuit and a bikini, it was a teen body. And Namor's World War II love interest, Betty Dean, got brought back as a recurring character to watch over Namorita, sort of as like a benevolent aunt type. In this run, Namor fought the old foe of his, Byra and Lyra, the Lemurian. But most notable were the multiple sequence of Namor battling, at that time, X-Men villain Sunfire. He keeps popping up in odd places, doesn't he? Deathlok in the other episode? Now here. Namor cites his experience during the battle with Sunfire, fighting flamed foes across decades, and two different individuals who call themselves the Human Torch. So he's got that going for him. They do battle around a sea vessel that becomes damaged and sinks with all hands abandoning the ship. It's a horrific scene, and it's rendered wonderfully by Everett, and it's really reminiscent of like a war comic scene from an earlier era. The whole run, it just feels important and historical to me. I mean, it's Everett's last work. He was going to be drawing a Marvel team-up issue with Spider-Man and Namor, and that never came to fruition. It's really, this work here, it's drawn as beautifully as ever, and it's on his signature creation, you know? I think everyone who supported Bill and allowed these issues to take place deserve a lot of thanks. You got to check them out in the Marvel Masterworks Submariner Volume 7 and let me know what you think. I'll post some images of some panels through our Facebook and Twitter accounts at Marvel Noise and the Marvel Noise Facebook page. All right, now let's get on to those Thunderbolts like we promised. Later.
I am on Counter Earth. The situation is desperate.
Welcome, Marvel Noise listeners. It's the segment that could not be stopped. Marvel's most wanted Justice Like Lightning, Thunderbolts, is back in the house. Thunderbolts segment is currently consisting of me, Andrew the LA Rabbit, a relative Thunderbolts newbie who jumped on in the modern era, and was convinced to do a complete reread of the series by WWX Kev.
Yeah, now I'm here forever because you bought all those comics, so I'm here.
And to class up the joint and make sure we don't spend 17 hours on three comics, it's Super Steve from the bunker.
Woohoo! I was smattered back and forth into the Thunderbolts at various times, picking up issues when they interested me in different arcs, but I was off the book by this time, so this is the first time I've read these issues.
Oh, and I guess we should mention that we've been doing this Thunderbolt segment so long that the book's been canceled and is now coming back in a few months. So I guess I'm looking forward to that. How do you guys feel on that?
We've been laying the foundation all this time, Kev.
That's weird.
I'm definitely interested in checking out the new series. This whole reread has been pretty fun. I know the Marvel Noise listeners have a lot of patience because we've been doing this for quite a long time, but
the patience is paying off with this, right? With the fact that Citizen V is coming back, the Thunderbolts coming back, and my kids just got the new Lego Marvel Avengers video game, and one of the pre-order like extra character packs is classic Thunderbolts, including Jolt.
Wow, that's the pack I picked up. Thanks to you, Steve. I ran down to Best Buy and I was like, nice. I will pay your prices if I get some Thunderbolts. And they said, we'll take your money, sir. So, Thunderbolts. We're entering the era of the sort of split continuity. So we are currently at 66, but Kevin, maybe you want to tell the fine folks, who are these Thunderbolts?
All right. I'll first say, too, that this is when the Thunderbolts went bi-weekly. We decided to split up the issues since part of our Bolts are on Counter-Earth. And the other Bolts are on Earth proper. I'm only giving the lineup our Thunderbolts that are on Counter-Earth, which is also known as Planet Doom.
It's the Heroes Reborn world, right?
Yes.
Which is funny, because here they are. The original Thunderbolts are on the Heroes Reborn world, when that was the catalyst for their whole formation in the first place, was the heroes going away, right?
Yes. So we have, for our Thunderbolts lineup, Baron Zemo, who's our fearless leader, again. Carla is Moonstone, receives her powers from a Moonstone gem. You got Eric and Dallas, who is our Mr. Big. You know, it's hard to keep this Rocky and Bullwinkle gag going. Like, I thought I could put it through, but this isn't working out. Gee,
Rocky. I'm glad it made it two people into the roster before it fell apart on you.
But we usually call them Bubblegum because they don't really have a good name. Like, they still sort of call them Atlas, but they use the same body. We got Abe, who is now Mac 3. He has a suit of tech armor. He flies. I got Norbert, who is the fixer. He's smart. He fixes things, usually. We got Haley, who is Jolt. She does stuff with electricity, basically.
Like, turns into it.
Yeah, she's bioelectric. She's looking a little blue on the cover to issue 66 here, which also has the new logo.
New logo, going bi-weekly, this new crazy storyline. So even though it was bi-weekly, it swapped pretty cleanly, actually really cleanly, the stories of the two different groups. So we're gonna go with the even numbers here and go 66, 68, 70, 72.
Yeah, we're breaking with going as it came out and everything. It kind of reminds me of the first Thunderbolts segment where we didn't even go page by page. We were just jumping around all over the place, and we're back to doing that again by the issues this time. Well, and this issue is basically a recap fest and Jolt, like, writing something into a computer. I don't know, the Thunderbolts usually like writing things and then deleting the stuff later on. Like, maybe they'll write a letter and then they'll throw the letter into the fire after they're done with it. And this is another one of those issues, and it right, sort of goes into what every character is doing on this Counter-Earth and how Jolt factors into that and what she thinks of them.
Deathlok used to throw out his journal entries and letters, too.
He didn't put them on tapes, and then he erased the tapes?
And this, despite the Zercher Bay cover, we have a creative team split because of the enhanced schedule. We can't be expecting everybody to be penciling and inking, so it is Fabian Nicienza again, still. But it's Chris Batista with pencils and Rich Parada inks. And, of course, Richard Starkings, Comic Craft Letters, and Hi-Fi Design for colors.
And really prescient this. There that Batista in the crowd scene where the opening double page splash credit page where Jolt's flying over the head of the crowd in a baseball cap and a, looks like a scarf of some kind, is Counter-Earth's Obama.
And as Kevin told you, this is a recap issue, setting the table and following some of the traditional Thunderbolts. Every once in a while likes the recap. One element they do is, in describing their origin, I did like these split faces, where it has the supervillain name and the new superhero. That's a very Thunderbolt-y technique to do.
I like how, other than Mach 3, everyone's kind of going with their supervillain look and name now on Counter-Earth, which is funny.
And they're also ditching a lot of the masks too, and kind of just being their own pretty faces, because they're heroes on this earth.
See, that's what I like though. Zemo, he always had an ugly face. I like him scarred by Adhesive X or whatever.
Yes, if you missed the last episode, he did a brain transfer with Counter-Earth Zemo. Mm-hmm. So he now has a new perfect pretty body. And the setup is they're trying to save this world because Counter-Earth is kind of completely falling apart. So they're all running around, and Haley is almost completely recovered. They still have her with a cane from her revival, but her speech impediment, mercifully, is completely removed from the speech bubbles.
Dude, I'm sick of Counter-Earth always falling apart, or Galactus is going to eat it, or... man. High Evolutionary is going to do something with it.
I figured they did the recap here, too, because maybe the bi-weeklies is bringing Thunderbolts more attention, so they want to get everyone up to speed if you wanted to jump on right now, even though people don't know that the book will shortly be ending slash changing.
Hey, spoiler, I haven't read ahead. I've only read these the four issues we're covering here now. Don't be ruining it. The one... I will say the Zemo has a bit more of a sense of humor, maybe, than we've seen in the past.
It's heroic Zemo.
And is it him, or is it the way that Batista draws his faces when he's doing his, like, scrunched-up faces and stuff?
Well, he's also saying, like, the whole exchange where she's like, don't be smug about it. Did I just look smug? And it just seems like that wouldn't be...
Yeah,
that's more of the kind of witty banter than I would expect out of Hair Zemo.
Yeah, no, so it looks like Spider-Man standing there, you know, with his foot in his mouth as someone walks out of the room. Did I err?
You get a little bit more insight on Dallas here, and she's just drawing nobody that's important. But you got to figure it's like the Crimson Cowl or something like that.
The one, while she goes and kind of gives profiles of everybody, the one point I thought was really good that I liked is after her exchange with Zemo. She has in her colored thought, well, not thought bubbles, because, you know, it's comics. We don't believe in thought bubbles. In her thought captions, I like the point about, she's like, how can a man who's failed so often be so sure of himself? And I'm like, that's a good point. Like, Zemo really is a loser.
Yep, I thought same thing.
But he was supremely, he's always got that confidence. And it's like, that's an interesting... an important take on the character that I kind of liked.
And important on her, as revealing her criticism of it, too, because earlier it has her wrestling with the fact that, or admitting that she's really ticked off that he's been calling all the shots, and so far they've been right 100% of the time, too. Right? So she's got that going for her, where she's, like, admiring him on one hand, and she's wondering how can he, you know, she's becoming sure in him. So it's interesting. It's a lot more character than I'm used to getting from Jolt.
Yes, I thought this whole... like, I thought it was a really good set the table. I think they've done a good... every time they've done it, I've always thought it's well done with an economy of... I mean, it's a whole issue, but you feel like you're getting a lot out of it. And it turns out she's not thinking these things. She's writing them to Charcoal. And Kevin, who's Charcoal? Left him off the roster.
That wizard contest where you were supposed to create a hero for Marvel, and then Garabaton killed him for, well, there's other out-of-story reasons why Marvel didn't want to use him. But anyway, he still hasn't reformed himself, apparently. He's the only one that doesn't come back to life.
Well, what's great, so too, about this issue, and again, it's after a bunch of crazy stuff was happening in the series, see previous episodes of Marvel Noise, for the entire story. But this is a great, one of those great character issues where they are doing recap and through Jolt kind of exploring who the different characters are and giving them each their couple of pages of kind of her thoughts on them. And it lets the readers kind of know. You know, it's almost like the those great Peter David X-Factor issues where they would go and in their, like, debriefing therapy thing, right? And you'd get to have those little, for a couple of pages, just have Strong Guy giving you his spiel or Madrox or whatever. And those issues are fun. And that's exactly what's going on here. I really enjoyed the couple of Moonstone pages. And it kind of advanced everybody's story in singular ways while at the same time, the reason why she's being so reflective is because they're nuking Japan. They're nuking Japan to get rid of some spatial time anomaly thing. And that's heavy.
The planet's really ripping itself up. And I do like that the art team throws in a hoof-foot homage in the book as well and gives Jolt the classic Bagley lower goat halves in a few panels. So that was a nice reminder of the old days. But, Moonstone's got some weird looking. That outfit is not good.
No, it's terrible.
I mean, I know we're going to be stuck with that outfit for a long, long time, but the boots, that weird headgear.
It's awful.
You know, Fixer, you'd think he would mention something to Jolt about her goat feet, legs situation, since, you know, he's always a bit of a putz, as she says.
He doesn't even look up from his dirty magazine that he's reading while assigning them tasks to fix the planet. But it was also a fun take of the idea of, like, heroes not just punching bad guys in the face, but going and fixing dams and resetting up power stations and all that type of stuff.
I was going to say, at first, that techno page, I just thought was just over the top. Like, what? He's reading a smut mag? That's kind of silly to put in there. But then I realized, you know what, it's reflecting how much more into the flesh he's become, because he got really techno for a while. Yeah. Right. And we're identifying here, he's like drinking a cup of coffee, doing a Rubik's Cube, and reading a dirty magazine. So he's really enjoying the pleasures of the flesh and the buzz of the caffeine and the taste and all that sort of, he's soaking in being more human than robot, which is, so I guess that was imagery-wise an important and didn't need to be described more.
You know, Mac 3 seems becoming more robotic.
It's true.
Yeah, he's the one that's not handling this well. And then we do have a, they do throw in the letters page, and they inform us that this is Tom Brevoort's last issue as editor. So,
getting off the sinking ship. Good. Getting off, yes, the sinking, exactly, ship.
Kevin,
was that troubling you back in the day, the Brevoort leaving?
I don't think so. It was kind of like, you probably could feel that, like, this book wasn't, like, it was popular, and it goes for, like, quite a while. Like, how many books, like, get this far anyways? Like, issue 66. But then you're like, well, Marvel seems to be, like, giving it some effort again by giving it a bi-weekly and everything. So you're like, well, the book can't be doing that badly if they're willing to do stuff like that.
And it isn't that Brevoort left. And it's not just Brevoort, but it's Brevoort's assistant editor was also plenty capable, too, Mark Sumerak. But the book was leaving. The book was leaving their office. The book was getting shuffled down the hall, basically. And when you see where it's headed, you know, not too much disrespect intended for that office, but it's not an office that has stuck around in Marvel. It went down to Andy Liss and Lynn Yashil's office. So the book was getting passed on, and changes would be coming right around the corner.
Yeah, like,
and they'd fail. So, and then they would turn back and try to come back to the old continuity again. So, you know.
Like, I think this book is, like, a half step on a pace with, like, where Marvel is. Like, they're sort of, like, the new revitalized Marvel at this point. So you had a few books, like the Avengers, too, that were not entirely going where Marvel was going at this time. Like, until the Thunderbolts get revitalized again.
Well, as if you're reading along at home, remember, kids, we're skipping right up to 68, which cover features a reverse gender Black Bolt.
What? But what? Look at this snazzy jacket that Moonstone's wearing.
Flak jacket with a Black Bolt jumpsuit underneath.
Yeah, I mean, I just, when I saw this cover, I was like, it looks odd. It's like kind of almost like a Melissa design in a way, what they're doing with Songbird, more than, well, we're going to find out this is Moonstone, but it doesn't look like any Moonstone I'm familiar with. And this time, there's a little bit of the cover lists Andrew Peepoy as one of the editing, although the credits inside do not list him.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I don't know, maybe he helped out Parada. I'm not sure. Andrew Peepoy is still around today, and I see him in a lot of the shows.
Yep. He's a good guy.
My cover's damaged. It has a line going all the way down the left-hand side near when it starts to get towards the staple. I don't know, it's like, I guess it was maybe in the box or whatever that it got to the comic shop and mine got damaged.
A whole other $1.50 in Canada. That's a ripoff.
I think mine might be the same way, Kevin. The third left of my page is all black. I mean, there's lettering and stuff, but there's no image there.
On mine, it says 225 US, 375 Canadian. Dope.
Yeah, I know.
That's rough.
The dollar was crashing at this point in 2002. Oh, what? Just like today.
This issue was the best of the bunch, I thought. I liked this one because it's a murder mystery.
Yeah, this is probably the best. You know, they had this bi-weekly and everything, and they have twice as many issues, but they have twice as many Thunderbolts. But still, it seems like they're like, oh, we're going to get into this story about helping everyone, murder mysteries, and how do you save a planet? And it seems like that's quickly abandoned. So this is like your one issue where you get to explore, like, what if there's a murder in, well, the Thunderbolts are... Did we mention that they're on this, like, the island, and they saved, like... Was it, like, millions and millions of people? This where this murder takes place. But I wanted to see, like, more of that. Like, how do they save people? And
they keep making it more compartmentalized, right? So they're on Counter-Earth, and they're sort of ruling Counter-Earth in a weird way. And then they nuke Japan, but beforehand they have their floating island that they've brought everybody up to. So now that's their little, you know, smaller sovereign nation that they're in charge of. So at least it gives... a smaller scale ground for them to cover and police. And yeah, so we get this mystery here, which is a cool one because, you know, all along since the beginning, there's always been a little bit of mystery of both the intentions of Carla Moonstone and also her power. And it has really evolved as the series has gone on. And here it is evolving again. I think that was... You know, the big part of this story as well was doing what it's going to do to Moonstone.
And I think there's a grand Thunderbolts tradition to have somewhere in the issue that Carla's naked again. So that's how you open up the issue with her with Phantom Eagle, which is Counter-Earth's Moonstone. And she's willing her clothes to come off in the clouds.
But it's not really her. He's imagining that it's her. It's really some poor girl, and he's killed her.
Well, you know what? I forgot this went on, so I remember in a previous episode that I mentioned that, oh, yeah, like 2002, Kevin's wondering about Carla's love life and everything. You know, a Phantom Eagle. And then I open up this issue, and I'm like, oh, geez, that actually... I was, like, concerned. I'm like, whoa, that actually happened. I actually spoiled things for you. But then... It's not real.
Right. No, she didn't have any feelings for him.
I kind of also was hoping they'd do a redesign of Zemo's outfit on this one. It's kind of like it's that black sort of under jumpsuit.
Yep.
Because he hijacked the Dread Knight or whatever that character was. So, and then to me, it's a little too close to the Fixer.
Yep, agreed.
But it opens with that sequence where he flies off and then suddenly the Thunderbolts are standing around the chalk outline. And Zemo's like, you know, well, it was a good run while it lasted, but 6 weeks is a long... So that was a clever way to, like you know, oh, they set up... They've been running around with that city for 6 weeks. And so that's a cool little way just to throw it in. And now he's like, we got to solve this mystery. You know, this will shake the town's confidence because it is this weird artificial city, not just in that it floats over the earth, but that it's made up of all these different refugees. Carla to find them. Or her. We know who the murderer is, but they don't.
And they get into a little bit of how things run with, like, they have these peacekeepers and how they make decisions and what they want to do in public.
Mercifully, for the entire issue, she skips that ridiculous headpiece.
Just around. As the clues start becoming more apparent and it looks more and more like it's Moonstone who did it, because of the phasing capability and stuff. If this had been more than a one-issue story, I would have enjoyed, you know, the zig and zag if they had implicated, you know, the female Moonstone kind of first. And it's like, hey, the only person with this power set around is you. And, you know, and then it turns up to be the other guy. But pretty quickly he makes his move and he's outed.
Yeah, he's going to, because they're discovering it, he's going to get the jump on the wheelchair-bound Dallas Reardon. What I thought was a really nice panel. We've had a little bit of goof and fun, but it's a very classic, like, superhero.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it would have been a perfect full page, and it's the quarter third where he's coming up on her unawares in a full charge floating through the window, but she's not so unaware because she bubblegums out in a heartbeat. And they get into the battle, but he's able to run away, and she is not able to, you know, because he can phase through, and she has to burst through the walls.
Right.
So he gets away, and she's kind of, I mean, well, she, he, because when she's in bubblegum form, she's also combined with Eric, so it gets kind of confusing. But whatever they are, they get kind of angry about it.
But Fixer can fix anything. So he rigs up a little device that will cancel out all phasing abilities. So Carla will be able to confront Phantom Eagle.
And it had been used before. It had actually cut her power off for about 20 seconds in the past. So they know, because it's worked on her, that it should work on this guy too.
But she's going to use it. But that's kind of risky. Cause,
it's going to take her power too for 20 seconds, right?
It's going to take her power, as Zemo points out. But she has a nice retort about, you got to draw them out, and unless you plan to wear a wig and a dress helmet, it's got to be her.
I wouldn't put it past him. He's come close. My Marvel Legends figure, he's got a skirt on.
Yeah, but you notice all the characters that wear skirts in the Marvel Universe, you do not want to mess with them. Like Doctor Doom, yeah. Like all these cosmic entities, like you're not going to make fun of those guys.
Skirts and half capes.
Half capes.
Don't mess with the half cape.
So it's a little compressed, which is super fine with me. I don't mind telling this in one issue. Like you say, Steve, I would have enjoyed if they'd stretched it out, but I'm also happy having it as a one and done.
Yeah.
So she does lure him out, and he sees her in her civilians. And he's like, Carla? And she's like, Lloyd? Click. And that puts the whammy on their powers, and then in the little caption bubbles, it's a countdown.
Yep.
And she's like, what's going on? And then she kisses him. That was a nice surprise.
Just to distract him and get him close.
And then in a brutal sequence, she just rips his gem right out of his body and takes it for herself. Like, not even thinking, she doesn't consult with anyone. She's just like, yeah, I'm taking this guy's stuff. We need to get rid of this threat. And then I'm taking the power for myself. No question.
Well, that's when you realize it was her plan all along. She just phases her hand into his chest. Because she knows the 20 seconds, that it worked 20 seconds on her. She figure on him, because he isn't as acutely able to use his powers as she is. They already had sequences before of her, or him dreaming of her teaching him stuff. So she figures that she's going to get her powers back before he does from this EMP blast. And she phases, rips out his gem, stuffs it in her own chest, and now she's doubly powered.
And now she gets a new costume.
Yeah, full page spread. Once she swallows the gem, she has this black bolt with like a white leather jacket look over it, which is an improvement, but I still would have...
Yeah, it's still pretty bad. But you could almost say that, like, Moonstone's... This is the payoff for Moonstone becoming a Thunderbolt in the whole first place.
So you think this disrupts the whole thing where, remember, they were going to come after her if she used the gem for evil? Like, this messes up that whole thing, right?
Just try.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's twice as powerful now, and she has crazy eye black and can't see her pupils. So that means you know she's trouble.
And I don't remember what happened to Moonstone, so I want to find out. This is interesting. I mean, the whole thing with... Remember with the Kree and the old gods and all that crazy stuff? And now she's too Moonstoned. She's Moonstoned.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a bit of sort of maybe the Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, what they did with her back in the day type of thing.
Like I said,
whenever you get powerful and you lose your pupils, that means things are different. But she has a change of heart because it turns out that he couldn't handle the psychic power. When he was phasing, it was making his mind go a little nuts. So she decides to let him out of jail. She's like, you can stay in jail or you can get out and start helping.
Doesn't that make you wonder about Carla's sanity, though? If it's happened to someone else with a gem?
No.
If she's got shrewd. Two gems.
She's shrewd. Okay. Could be coming because now it's double the power. But even just, you know, she's... This was a clever move on her part. Rather than soak up the resources of having to deal with this guy as a prisoner. There's only so many people on this floating island. Suck it up and get to work.
And then as Steve told us in the last episode, they nuked Tokyo to stop this. But our final page hints that maybe they didn't stop it as this weird anomaly pops up.
Oh boy.
And it goes, Father, Mother, I'm back. And this hand,
oh, no.
A bubblegum hand, reaches out, looking remarkably like Charcoal's father. And that's going to be a hell of a twist.
What?
Remember when he dropped in the goop and he kind of reached his hand up?
It's not Humus Sapien or whatever that guy's name was.
I thought this was Counter-Earth Jolt.
Come on. He looks a little bit like Charcoal's dad. Sure, they don't have the rights to Charcoal, but he must have the rights to his dad, right?
Yep. They can't do stories with a Kroyer, but they can do stories with Marionette and Bug.
So, 70, we're back to a full page cover again. And it's Mach, insert your favorite number here, with all these like weird...
You know, he has that M on his chest now, and he has those three bars to designate the three.
Oh, is that what that means? I thought that was just like his new logo.
I like how his middle and ring fingers go together on each hand, and he's got like a fat middle finger. It reminds me of, in a slight way, of the old suction cup hands when he was the Beatle.
Yeah, that's what I like, too.
Big mitt.
Tribute. To back when he was a good character.
So how about this stand-in artist? It is a young Stefano Caselli.
That is so weird. I think that's the neatest thing when you go back and you read some old comics and you weren't paying attention to the artists or they were like a nobody to you. And then you're like, wow, that was so-and-so back when, you know, that's neat.
So you guys know that, like I've said many times, that in high school I got out of comic books. And sometime in my undergrad in college, I got back into comics right around like 1989, 1990 or so. And all my long boxes were all sitting in my closet back in my parents' house. And many of them were still unbagged and just in boxes. And I decided whenever I went home to visit my folks or home for vacations or holidays or whatever, I'd spend some time hanging out you know, bagging the comics and indexing them and really getting a good list of what was there and that sort of thing. So I decided when I was going to bag my comics that I wasn't sure how often I'd ever really be going back and pulling these things out. So what I did was I used the little white, like 1-inch by 1/2-inch labels. And what I did was write the artists who were involved in the issue. And if there were two storylines or two different stories, there were two separate labels. If there was a pinup, I stuck a little extra thing there. So like going back through all these old issues, in hindsight, and this was me in the like early 90s going back and looking at, you know, the old comics from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, finding so many gems of like, wow, that artist did this and that artist did that. He, you know, because people had become somebody by then and become legends in their own rights, that second and third wave of comics creators. So that was really fun, especially with the annuals and stuff, because they would have all those backup stories and all those little, you know, Spidey power charts and all that stuff. So it was really fun to log in, like we were talking about the last episode with the Deathlok stuff, that George Perez's first work was that 2-page, like, editorial of Deathlok's creation with Doug Munch and Rich Buckler in the back of Astonishing Tales 25. That's cool. That's the stuff you come across when you're flipping back through these old books. And this is kind of like a modern version of that same thing. Like, oh, yeah. Hey, look, Stefano Caselli.
And Scott Koblish did the inks for the cover with the Zercher.
Yeah, a bunch of creepy people.
Creeple.
Yeah, they're sort of colored, sort of out of phase a little bit, and their eyes are all have the Psylocke glow around them. But this takes us to Paris. And if you don't remember, Paris and Counter-Earth is not all that nice a place. It was completely destroyed, and it's covered by some radiation haze.
Looks a lot like Tokyo.
Mach 3 and Joel are there investigating. And Mach 3 fires some probes into the thing, but he picks up movement, and there's not supposed to be. So the panel shows there's all these weird ghost people in it. And he's like, I got to go save those people, but Joel, you can't go because the energy will rip apart your bubblegum form. He doesn't use the term bubblegum, but I do. And so he dashes in reckless, and as Kevin told us, he's been acting kind of weird and not responding. We all figure he misses his girlfriend screaming Mimi. But he's just throwing himself in, and this is another one. But when he gets down there, like, the people are crazy, like they're hungry, they're in pain, they're nuts, so they sort of overwhelm his armor.
Yeah, they're weighing him down.
And they snap the wings off of it.
No!
And he's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, they shouldn't be able to do that. And he's in real trouble. And in the meantime, Joel had to wait for the backup crew to show up with some crazy, funky-looking insect-type ship that looks really cool. Did you guys like that design with, like, the little legs that come out? Yeah. And, like, it's got an open deck and everything. I'm like, that's a cool layout.
Yeah, I guess they didn't want to send the whole island there, so they just... I guess this was available, or maybe they found this and put it on the island to use later on. I'm not sure which.
That insecty-like hull, though, has that sort of Starjammer, Shi'ar, Cockrum-type design look to it a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's a good... Yeah, I just thought it was a fun... Like, instead of just the old Flying V or whatever, that was cool. They busted out this funky-looking ship for it. So they're all trying to pierce together because, like, there's nothing down there.
Nothing at the Café Bonjour.
So Fixer puts it together that what happened was is it's the brainwaves of the people. We're like, so it's just echoes of them.
Yeah, and Abe's just running around crazily without his mask on, going, these ghost people are after me. His heart isn't really in this whole rescue. No.
Are they running into the Café Bonjour or out of the Café Bonjour? I can't tell.
Well, Caselli really adds a lot of expression to the faces, too. There's a phone call where Fixer dials him up, and it's a little exaggerated, but to good effect, I think. I like the call between him where he's like, it's all in your head, you moron. And he's like, tell it to the people chasing me.
No, that cannot be allowed to happen.
Yes, oh, you like that?
It practically punches you in the face. It does, actually. The words, as lettered, are so large that they literally punch Mach 3 in the face.
It's true. And he's kind of grimacing there, going, ooh.
And it knocks Joel over, and it blows the hair back on Zemo. Zemo looks like, I don't know, like he's a character out of Archer and Armstrong or something. He always has like a 5 o'clock shadow in his hair, so he's messed up. He's not how I picture, like, the fastidious German soldier, you know what I mean?
And then we are introduced to the Rip. Apparently they're living manifestations of order and chaos. And I'm like, hey, Steve must know some other guys that are order and chaos.
That's the first thing I'm thinking of is like, well, what does Master Order and Lord Chaos have to think about that?
Well, shouldn't these guys be counter order and counter chaos? But I guess counter order would make everyone think of a diner, so... But they have been created to balance all that is right and wrong on this world. The problem is, there seems to be a lot more wrong than is right. Like, this world doesn't seem in balance in any way whatsoever.
Oh, man.
So they're going to do a whole Celestials thing here? They're going to give their thumbs up or their thumbs down to Counter-Earth?
Can I? I give double thumbs down. to counter. Other than that recent Robinson, James Robinson Fantastic Four run story, which I thought had a clever Counter-Earth Heroes Reborn tie into it. I just don't like the Heroes Reborn world.
Well, one of them is like a masculine purple energy guy who's a giant. And the other is like a white-clad woman. They both have glowing eyes, and they're both giants. And I think they're supposed to evoke those characters like Kevin and Steve are talking about, these kind of...
And it's supposed to be a yin-and-yangy thing, too, you know?
Yes.
And they're attached kind of by connected. The deltoid, which is gross. Just gross.
And they point out that they were sort of birthed. Their arrival destroyed Paris. Oops, they're bad.
Yeah.
But the advantage is that it's keeping the spatial anomaly that is ravaging this world at bay. So they're not connected to that anomaly. They're separate from that.
No, we just destroyed Paris. But we're not...
Right.
The thing that you destroyed Tokyo over was completely different. Right.
It was unplanned and unfortunate.
So they're peers. We've each destroyed large cities on Counter-Earth.
But Mach 3 is pretty upset about that because, sure. You know, he's like, well, we need to save these people.
He's so upset that he grows an extra finger on his gloves when he fires up his fat middle finger thing with the ring finger and middle finger attached. Nope. Now he's got 5 digits.
I think he broke them apart. Unattach his 2 fingers. Like you can like sort of bind them together, or then they unattach.
No prize for you.
It's like a reverse Ultron. I like or Voltron. I like that, Kevin. But he's angry, and basically, for some reason, these two, the Rip, the Chaos, and Order, decide that they've been sacrificed for the greater good, so they have to stay there. They don't really explain why. I guess that by being there, they say they form a buffer or a cork to stop the anomaly, but it sounds pretty suspicious, and
yeah.
Zemo and the Fixer are also pretty suspicious of this whole thing.
We'll just be here in the dead Paris with all these ghost people. Go destroy other cities.
Fixer Mach figure out a cool plan to solve this. Go ahead, Kevin.
I might want to read that Marvel book, The Ghost Detective.
I think that's Ghost Boy Detective, and I think that's from Vertigo.
Oh.
But
I thought it was Ralph and I think it's Sue, wasn't it? They were supposed to be ghost detectives.
So
the Dibneys?
Yes.
So
Fixer
asks Zemo, what's the call? And Zemo's like, we need to do it. You distract the big guys and let's put these people out of their misery. I mean, they don't necessarily want to be put out of their misery. But Mach 3 uses an EMP, which for some reason gets rid of the brainwaves.
I like that Zemo deferred to Mach 3. It's like, all right, you're on the cover this issue. You know what I mean? This is obviously, you're really hung up about this thing. Like, you're right. Go with your plan.
Hey, if something goes wrong, it's not like they can mess up the world more than it already is anyways.
And the EMP works. It sends all the people all back to wherever they were, you know, releases those ghosts or whatever, but it fries Mach 3's armor.
So they've chosen to doom the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the sake of a few measly souls.
Ghost souls.
But
the Cafe Bonjour.
But as he's saying that, on a page turn, someone blasts the Rip. And it turns the page, and it's Ultron coming out of the Earth, which I was very surprised to see.
It's not Annihilus?
With yellow armor? It's not one of the Slingers? What is it? Prodigy? Or...
That's good.
Because that head looked like Ultron to me.
It's Nuclo.
Kind of with the ionic energy in it.
It's something from the Age of Apocalypse.
Holocaust?
I do. You know what I do like, though? He's, even though his arm is completely extended downward in like the anatomical position, the hand comes up in a Kirby hand. So it's got like, yes, the Kirby fingers and the Kirby thumb. That's beautiful.
And the other hand is also, like, the arm is all stiff, but his wrist is bent completely as well. But it's repeating the mother, father, I am still with you line. So it's got to be that thing from before.
Right.
And he identifies himself as the anomaly. I still maintain it's Ultron, Counter-Earth Ultron, but willing to take other guesses as his identity.
Issue 72, I think, has a beautiful cover from the blend of the kind of darkness around the edges. It's not cross-hatching, but it's just a nice color blend to the yin and yang with the red behind it, and then this figure that looks really cool as it's designed here. I mean, the artwork is so tight, I almost thought it was like a Joe Quesada Palmiotti piece when I first looked at it, but it's Juan Babillo. Really nice.
Yes, in this cover, he clearly doesn't look like Ultron at all, so I was wrong. But we're back to Chris Bautista as our penciler after that fill-in issue. And the anomaly kind of fries, knocks out all the Thunderbolts, and is a little bit schizophrenic because he kind of seems like he's talking to his dad and his mom as he goes on about, do these people deserve to live or die, or what's going on, and gives a nice little recap.
Wait, is this that guy that they left in Tokyo and then they blew it up?
Exactly.
Exactly. But what this guy didn't count on is the one Thunderbolt that had been left behind but shows up on the scene is the brand new Moonstone.
Yeah, you
blows
like
him apart.
Like, do you think this guy's all powerful, some cosmic guy? He's like monologuing, doing all this stuff, and then Moonstone just comes by and goes yoink and destroys him just like that.
Which just makes you realize Moonstone is completely OP, right? She's so overpowered right now.
Yeah, and she's like, I don't feel anything. And she keeps on saying stuff like that, and you're like, whoa, might want to scale up your humanity a little bit there.
Yeah, have no idea what we're dealing with now with Moonstone. that's the thing that I'm most intrigued about as this storyline wraps up, is what's going on with Moonstone yet again.
And they point out that, as you guys said, it's a kid from Tokyo, that the weird kid they left behind. Mm-hmm. And they describe this thing as a cancer, the null field energy. And luckily they're able to trace it, because when she blew him apart, his armor remained. He's like he looks a lot like a bubblegum guy, maybe like a Simon Williams type, who's all energy contained within a couple pieces of armor. And that armor has the trace, and they're able to track it.
Are you saying Kirby dots are kind of like bubblegum?
Just in the sense of his composition being energy contained within some system. I was going to say, it reminds me of Wildfire from the Legion of Superheroes, but I think that's a reference that will be lost on some Marvel Noise listeners.
Well, I thought he kind of looks like Firestorm, too.
Hey, we already mentioned the Dibnies.
The stealth episode of DC Talk buried in the Marvel Noise. But, so they go to the Mir Diamond Mine in Siberia, which goes 2,000 feet into the ground.
That's pretty crazy.
That's where they track the energy, too.
Yeah, they kind of get into the physics and Franklin and how he created, like, another world and, like, what he knows of the worlds and what he created and like, what might be shared between our Earth and Counter-Earth.
I don't know if you guys had this flashback, but when they're standing on the edge and Moonstone is next to Zemo, they remind me a lot of, like, the Fenris twins.
Hmm.
Like, with kind of, because their outfits kind of match and the blonde and everything. I was like, that's who they are.
There's been some comments that they might have been, since all the people on the island were, like, worshipping them and cheering and everything, they're, like, gossiping, and they're like, is Zemo and Carla and Item and all these type of things, or the Fixer is cute or whatever. So it kind of reminds me of that, too.
Only on Counter-Earth would the Fixer be cute.
Apparently.
Or competent. As they head down in, though, the ionic energy fluctuation is messing with Atlas. So Atlas has to go human form because it's better that way. But Atlas is taken off the table as an active participant.
Right.
And what do they find at the bottom? But a giant spaceship.
Phased into the walls of the large crevasse they're going down, big long tube tunnel they're following down. So it's just like resting in the tube with its wings and part of its hull phased into the bedrock. It's crazy. And that's when they get into the whole Franklin thing. You know, Counter-Earth was created by Franklin from his memories of Earth as a child and somehow tapped into the subconscious knowledge of most of the people on Earth about what they know about Earth. Weird.
Yeah,
something that I'm a little bit worried about, all those realities he was creating at the end of Secret Wars.
Exactly.
They all have giant spaceships in the middle of their planets, and maybe that guy wasn't so good at that. You know, and I'm just saying that we're having some evidence that he might not be the architect everyone thought him to be.
Do not bounce Super Happy Fun Ball. If Super Happy Fun Ball starts to glow, back away from it.
Well, can you remember you had the ball as the Earth, so if someone sits in that, can they, like, squash the universe, like on that Futurama episode? but, of course, this was Franklin's practice run, so I assume as he got older, he got better at doing that stuff.
I mean, he's building whole universes. He couldn't even do a planet, so...
Yeah, this time he's got Reed to help.
But as they're having this quiet moment of trying to figure this out, suddenly a STA, surface-to-air missile fires.
Oh, no.
You see, the last issue, there was a WOM, word of mouth. I wasn't familiar that people referred to that as a WOM.
I think a WOM is a space knight, Kevin.
Oh.
And it's finally someone I've been waiting for a while, the real heroes of Counter-Earth, the Young Allies.
Oh, yeah.
How many issues ago was that? I mean... Like, weren't we... I was expecting them to come up a little bit earlier, because it seems like they've been... you know, they were the Counter-Earth good guys, and they guilt-tripped everybody when they left that one about how they were dooming Counter-Earth and everything. So they finally show up.
How is Kid Colt with them?
That's all they had left.
Ay, ay, ay.
And they got Bucky and...
Oh, it looks like the Rip is with them as well.
Well, they have their own bubblegum character.
She gets pretty rippy, though.
And basically they're like, oh, no, you know, we're the Young Allies. And she's like, that ship's going to destroy. They weren't firing at them. They were firing at the ship, because if that ship stays, it'll destroy the whole planet.
You know, my favorite moment of this whole thing is, though, is when Zemo and Bucky meet each other. They're like, Bucky. The other one says, Zemo. They stare each other down.
Zemo's kill them all. Some Joel's like, hey.
Some bad cat blood.
Let that old stuff go. And that's when Rip points out that the Rip has now merged into like a weird, like it can talk and change form, and it's not two people joined at the shoulder anymore, which I'm grateful for. Like, this Earth is doomed. And Bucky's like, well, for this world to save, your Earth has to die. And that kicks off a big fight that lasts for a few pages.
We're not going to have our Earth be destroyed and then be left with this Counter-Earth that's...
Definitely not. Well, not with no Paris?
Jeez.
No Tokyo?
Not our world. They mean the 616 world. Not our world. They meant your as in there.
Well, the 616 got destroyed anyway eventually, so whatever.
Wouldn't that have been weird if Counter-Earth was still going? They're like, hey, where'd the other world Earth go?
Hope Franklin doesn't rename the guy with the horns.
So there's a 3-page fight, and then what made me laugh was Bucky and Jolt are talking, and Jolt's like, you didn't let me finish, or Bucky was like, you never finished what we were going to say. Your Earth has to die, but we know sacrificing one Earth for another isn't right, so we're going to figure out a new solution. And it's like, why didn't you start with that?
I know. So it was like an episode of Three's Company where like they overhear, like... You know, Jack saying that he's going to do one thing and go down to the Regal Beagle for something, and that they didn't finish hearing him saying that, oh, and Janet's really not pregnant. So, we thought he was because we listened behind the swinging door to the kitchen, and we were just listening in there, and we only heard part of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know what the problem was? They say, we're not here to hurt anyone, and then the Young Allies are all like, actually... I'm like, that's not the good way to when you had other things to say.
It was just one of those ones that made me laugh a little. Like, it was totally sitcom-y.
Yep.
But
they had to fight first.
You know, they still have their telepath who tells them to chill out. And but Anomaly shows up. So apparently, you know, Carla didn't do that much damage to him.
He recomposed. Excuse me while I compose myself.
And then he's confused, but for others to live, this one must die. He doesn't know what to do. But then suddenly he fires a beam and says, show yourself. And it's Zemo comes out saying he can figure this dilemma out. I can help you save this planet, even if it means the sacrifice of your homeworld. Zemo says no, especially because it means the real Earth will die.
Oh boy, he's gone full evil.
He's holding this piece of tech in his hand. Is that supposed to be like the ultimate nullifier or something? Or just something he found on the ship? Or I guess we'll find out next episode, True Believers.
I know, we chose like a crazy next cutoff.
Two planets. One choice. What would a hero do?
Well, we know, because we just did all this with the incursions and stuff. You save your own planet, and you make a bomb and blow up the other one, or you get an infinity gauntlet and you blow up the other one.
And then all hope lies in doom.
Exactly. So then, next time we get together and talk about this, we'll be actually backtracking and do 67, 69, 71, and 73 is where both storylines converge? Or is it 74 where they both converge on the way to the big issue 75 blockbuster finale of the Thunderbolts as we've known them all along?
Well, I believe on the last page of 73, spoilers, it starts converging.
Okay, cool.
Hey, I'm not listening.
We're just talking structure. We're just talking structure here.
And you know what's funny, too? If you read the letters pages, they already mentioned that 75, everything concludes, and then they say, well, what's going to happen to the book after that? And then they say, ask Andrew.
Well, I don't know. I just got here.
Well, that's not very comforting.
I certainly would have known in 2003 or 2002 if they'd asked me. I wouldn't have known. I wasn't even reading this book back then.
Well, that doesn't leave us with too much confidence then, does it?
Yeah.
Kevin, for those of you that may not recall, kept a log of him when he was reading these originally. So sometimes we get a glimpse back to what old Kevin thinks.
Yeah, but he stopped updating the website at this point. So...
Consider this the update.
No, but I have a general idea, and he did some calendar stuff. Like, these stories were way more straightforward, and then they started getting into the, you know, a little cosmic with the rip and all that, so he wasn't quite as happy with this stuff. Since, you know, we've long dispensed with, like, most of the subplots and all that stuff, so... You know, it reads way faster, too. Like, you can probably whip through these.
You could whip through all four issues really comfortably in an hour without missing a word, for sure.
Yeah. It's kind of entering a different phase.
So, do you think old Kevin was liking this new phase or not liking it?
He wasn't liking it as much.
He sees the writing on the wall. He's letting the web page linger without updates.
I know.
He's...
I think he's still...
He's bailing water.
I think he's still updating the news and some of the stuff, but he's not doing, like, the issue summaries and the comments. Like, he comes back to the comments and everything with, I think, issue 75, but I think someone else actually wrote the summaries for these issues. He's farming out the work.
Can't bring himself to do it.
Oh, 2002, Kevin. I'm disappointed in you.
He was in school. He had work to do.
What does 2016 Kevin think?
Pretty much the same thing. I think I might have been a little rough on the issues at the time. Like, I think it's perfectly enjoyable, but I guess compared against the stuff, like not knowing what was coming later, like, it's fine, but I can see where he was coming from. Like, yeah, it is a little breezier, but still good.
All right, next episode, we got it while it's still fresh. Let's do the other issues so we can converge on the big finale.
Yeah, I don't think now that the big glut of number ones and Secret Wars is over, hopefully faithful listeners won't have long to wait for our next installment of Marvel's Most Wanted, Justice Like Lightning Thunderbolts. Thanks for listening.